So I'm Rick Hansen, and it's November 30th, 2016. And we've been exploring mindfulness this year and working our way through the Buddha's direct path to enlightenment, as he called it, the establishing oneself in, or establishing mindfulness in, four major places, you could say. The body, second, the sense of experience as pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. Third, the craving or not craving that results from the sense of things as pleasant or unpleasant or neutral. And then fourth, some major themes, including the Four Noble Truths, the ways of subdividing consciousness, factors of awakening, and what are called the hindrances, the obstructions. And of those different lists, in the fourth foundation of mindfulness, I'm going to focus on two of them this year, in the remainder of the year. First, the factors of awakening, and then second, the hindrances. So I've done a little review of the factors of awakening in the last couple of times we've met. And the way to think of these, I think, is of as psychological causes. In other words, these are things we can engage ourselves that, in a sense, Coach Buddha tells us, you know, if you do these things, it will be good for you. And then we see for ourselves, is that actually true? Okay. So what are these factors or causes of enlightenment, which in early Buddhism is operationalized as a mind that is fundamentally free of suffering? There may be pain. There may be physical discomfort that's inescapable. There may be emotional discomfort that's inescapable. But there's no suffering around that. We're not adding any kind of insult to injury. And we have a mind in full awakening, full enlightenment, a mind that is incapable of any sustained experience of greed, broadly defined, or hatred, broadly defined, or delusion, broadly defined. That's a very psychological way to describe or define or operationalize enlightenment in the Buddhist tradition, which is open to the possibility of something infinite and transcendental, but is not dogmatic about it. So that seems like a pretty good thing to aim for. At least it seemed that way to me. And each time I kind of periodically check myself, does this path still make sense? Does it still look pretty good or around the next bend, as best I can tell? Or people further down the path, you know, all the way to full enlightenment, say, yeah, it's pretty good. Come on, keep going, you know? So you keep on going. So you work these factors. What are these factors? The first one in the list, and they're kind of in a sequence, is mindfulness. Then, based on that sustained present moment awareness of mindfulness, we investigate, we explore, we unpack, we deconstruct, we feel down into, we open wider. We start tracking causes, results. What happens when I do this? What happens when I do that? Investigation. To investigate, we need energy. So that's the third factor of awakening. We kind of mobilize energy. Passion, heartfeltness, ardency for the path. With that energy comes bliss or joy, which will be my main topic tonight, bliss or joy. And then after a while, that bliss or joy tends to kind of settle into tranquility, tranquility being the fifth factor of awakening, if I'm doing my list right. Mindfulness, investigation, energy, bliss, tranquility. Good. After tranquility, sixth, comes concentration, which really means non-ordinary absorption, profound clarity of mind, profound purification of mind, in Sanskrit, samadhi, some kind of deep attainment. And then on the heels of that comes sort of the arguably most important factor of all, equanimity. Relaxation is not having reactions. Equanimity is not having reactions to your reactions. It's like the most radical, the most ultimate inner shock absorber, a mind that can walk evenly over uneven ground. Okay? Got the review? Then you might ask yourself, where am I at with those different factors? Some of them might feel really active for you, accessible at will, really operating. Others, another one might strike you as, wow, that's interesting. That's a real opportunity. I'm going to think more about that. So in that context then, I want to explore with you tonight the factor of joy or bliss or rapture. And that factor is understood in certain contexts to have two aspects to it, given in two words in Pali, the language of early Buddhism, piti and sukha. Piti is more the bliss, the rapture, the whoa, I'm not in Kansas anymore thing. It's like arising or arousing as a kind of kundalini quality to it, maybe, what little I know about that. And it's like, whoa. And then there's sukha. The root of the word for sukha is sucrose, or sucrose and sukha have the same word root in Sanskrit, sweetness. There's a sweetness to sukha. It's a happiness. So also has qualities to it of contentment and tranquility. So, and I think it's okay to take these as sort of a cluster. So we have the more blissful, embodied, even orgasmic rush of rapture, and we have a more of an emotional, less of an embodied quality of happiness, of contentment and tranquility. You think of happiness and contentment and tranquility as kind of on a continuum in which there's a settling down, but an also opening into. You know, sometimes the bliss can be too much. After a while, you're like, enough already, you know? And then you kind of slide more into happiness, and after a while, happiness might feel a little gross, settle more and more into contentment, and then even contentment can become tranquility, particularly in, you know, sustained meditative practice. Okay, so I'm going to take the two together, sort of bliss and happiness, under the general heading of joy. All right. So how could these be factors of awakening? And how dare I talk about joy after Trump gets elected? So for some people, that's a real question. So I want to kind of put it in a broader perspective. So why could it be that in a contemplative tradition, Buddhism, that's grounded in a willingness to engage enormously ascetic, renunciate practices, why would it be that there would be such an emphasis on positive emotion, joyfulness, even blissfulness, as a factor of awakening? And also, traditionally, as two of the five major factors of the jhanas, which constitute the right concentration element of the Eightfold Path, these very profound, non-ordinary states of awareness. Why would it be that being stoked out of your mind could help you concentrate and meditate better and drop into these very non-ordinary states of consciousness? How could it be? Why are these beneficial? So I want to name three major benefits, as best I can understand them, of these joy factors, or reasons for welcoming joy, claiming joy, valuing joy, being an advocate for joy in oneself and others. Right? The first is that joy steadies the mind. What is steadiness of mind operationalized as? Now, steadiness of mind means that we can plop our attention on something beneficial and rest it there. In part because, in the traditional saying, the mind takes its shape from what it rests upon. So we want to be able to rest our mind on loving kindness or compassion or our own aspiration for awakening or our commitment to exercise or sobriety or commitment to restraint when dealing with people who may be aggravating, you know? We rest our mind on things that are beneficial to gradually grow into being them stably, and we want to be able to pull our mind away from what's not helpful, like ruminating in your mind, arguing with other people in your head, you know, arguing with people you see on TV talk shows, like what value is there in that, things like that. So, okay, so steadiness of mind is good, and deep steadiness of mind works the concentration factor of awakening. We're concentrated, we're deeply absorbed, we have a laser-like focus on our mind. Well, what does that actually mean? Well, steadiness of mind means essentially that whatever you're attending to stays in the neural substrates of working memory, which are supported mainly by the upper outer regions of your cortex. That's where kind of like RAM is located, in the brain, random access memory, like in a computer, all right? That's where those chips are plugged in, mainly. And sustaining attention to some particular content there, sensation, emotion, intention, realization, present moment awareness there. Sustaining that content means that the gates to the substrates of working memory are closed. So nothing new can get in and distract you. All right, so you stay with what's there. What keeps those gates closed are high and steady levels of dopamine, the neurotransmitter that tracks reward. So by sustaining intense positive emotion of one kind or another, including perhaps the intense positive emotion of tranquility that just pervades the mind, like, oh, I'm incredibly peaceful. You know, it sounds like contradiction, how to be incredibly peaceful. I'm intensely peaceful, but if it pervades the mind, it's functionally intense. And if you maintain high, steady levels of dopamine, you keep the gates closed to working memory. See how that works? The gates pop open if dopamine drops or if it spikes. So if you sustain dopamine at the top of its range, it's not going to drop and it cannot have a spike from something else. So you stay zeroed in on whatever you want to pay attention to. Isn't it kind of wild? All right. Second benefit is that as we experience the positive emotions, particularly more intense experiences of joy, that promotes in the brain factors, sometimes called neurotrophic factors, that make the brain more prone to or receptive to internalizing your experiences. In other words, learning from them. So by having particularly arousing or intensifying experiences of delight or exuberance or love or triumph or vim and vigor, you know, just all that, what we do is we make the brain more receptive to changing for the better. We help ourselves become more learnable, more able to steepen our learning curve in our practices. We prime ourselves for getting the most out of our practices by having joy. That kind of clear? Got it? It's like if what we're trying to do is both put the, if the brain is like a sponge, we're both trying to put the good stuff on top of the sponge that we want to become, compassion, insight, resilience, gratitude, self-worth, healing from trauma. That's what we want to become. That's what we want the sponge of the brain to absorb. And by experiencing and exploring joyfulness, authentic, I want to get to that in a minute here, but authentic joyfulness, we make the sponge spongier, more receptive to the good stuff that we're trying to help sink into it. Right? And then the third sort of benefit, and I think there are a few others, but I'm highlighting these three, of joyfulness, authentic joy, is that in the moment of joy, craving falls away. Joy is like a fast track into the third noble truth of not craving, of cessation of craving. Because when we feel joyful, right, when we feel really happy, intensely contented, really tranquil, really loved and loving, really satisfied, really awestruck, really grateful, you know, in that moment, there's no sense of deficit or disturbance inside. And that's the basis of craving, deficit and disturbance, something missing, something wonky, something wrong, something out of balance, right? So joyfulness is like a moment of awakening, because in awakened mind, there's no basis for craving, right? It's a taste, it's an intimation of enlightenment to be dropped into joy. Warlikeness falls away. I had a spiritual teacher for a while. He authored a book about food, but I love the title. It applies more generally. His title was, "The Eating Gorilla Comes in Peace." And it's true. when we feel already satisfied, when we're already delighted, when we're already just enraptured, blissed out, you know, full of enjoyment, in that moment, we're not at war with anybody. We're not fussing and feuding and fighting, right? We're not scratching and clawing. We're not elbowing others out of our way. We're like, oh yeah, you go forward. Oh yeah, you can have that parking space. You know, I'm blissed out. Like, what do I care? You know, right? That's pretty cool. Okay, so steadiness of mind, benefit. Helping ourselves become spongier to changing for the better. And third, an intimation of enlightenment and a falling away of craving and the suffering that results. Pretty good benefits. How to do it? First, to be really clear, if you watch your own mind, you can see that joy can occur alongside pain, alongside loss, alongside depression. It can be felt as deeper than anxiety, deeper than moral outrage, or alongside moral outrage on behalf of others. It's not either or. And to be really clear, I'm not talking about putting on a happy, smiley California face, looking at the world through rose-colored glasses or anything like that. That's the first point. If anything, we internalize the benefits of emotionally positive experiences to build up kind of muscles inside, inner strengths, for well-being in general, but also to deal with hard things, to deal with hard things inside ourselves, and to fuel ourselves for the long journey of helping the world become a better place. Okay. Context. In that context, one way to practice joy, to, in other words, welcome it, to invite it, to value it, to create sanctuary for it in the mind, is to look for ordinary opportunities in the flow of the day when there could be joy. You know, you turn and you see a yellow flower. Like, whoa. I came back to my car from a lunch with someone, I think day before yesterday, maybe it was yesterday, and then somebody had put a yellow rose on my car. I was in a parking lot in San Rafael. Like, I started looking around, like, what hustle is coming my way, you know? I wasn't so joyful, but then I went, ah, and like, a yellow rose. Like, what? You know? And what a neat opportunity. Or you're moving through your day and you just run into somebody, and you could have a spike. A little surge of joy. To be clear, sometimes joy is continuous and prolonged, right? Something happens and you're just, wow, you're just blissed out all day. But that's pretty rare, isn't it? Most joy is quick. It's like a little spike. And that makes it actually more accessible. Many little moments in a day, many little pearls, if you will, on the necklace of the seconds of your day. The more pearls, the better. So these little handful of second spikes of joy are available to us just going through our day. You know, I was just thinking about some crazy things that are opportunities for joy. Like you wake up, you crawl out of bed, whatever, you know, and then you work your way into the kitchen or something, and, you know, you turn a faucet or you do something and hot water. Like, wow, you know. You can drink it, or you shouldn't drink hot water, but you know what I mean. Like, ugh. Or, you know, you taste something, or you smell something, or you look at your partner, or you look out the window, or you see, in my case this morning, a big white crane swooping into our backyard. It was really beautiful until I realized he was there to eat the fish in my pond. And then I didn't enjoy him so much, but... You know, the moment of joy, right? Like a big bird in my backyard. What are you doing there? Oh, you know? Anyway, so point is, lots of little opportunities in the day. So what you might think to yourself, okay, come on. If you were on your own side and you wanted to, and you valued joy and you wanted to, you know, gain the benefits of it and give that to yourself, what are some of the little opportunities that are authentic to you over the normal course of your day in which you could... stop for joy, right? Like a stop sign, stop for joy, okay? Second is, independent of external conditions, we can routinely do little things that will evoke that little burst of joy, that little spike or moment or flash of joy. Like, just on your own, thinking of a place you've been, I come immediately pulling up right now to Tuolumne Meadows on Yosemite National Park. As soon as I just think about that place, I'm going to visualize it, I have like a spike of joy. Or bring to mind a person in your life. You're just so happy they're in your life. You're so glad. They drive you crazy sometimes, but you're still really glad they're in your life. That's an opportunity for joy. Or maybe thinking of something that you put behind yourself. Like, you are so glad you never have to work with that person again or live with that person. Or you're like so glad that you got through that fill in the blank, that tough year in college, that tour of duty and, you know, in the armed forces, that situation, that really tricky job evaluation that was unfair and you finally were exonerated, something like that. You know, you can think of things that immediately bring you joy. Like, I'm looking at that kind of Christmas tree over there, and I think about all the Christmases, you know, like the smell of the wood, and boom. You can self-generate joy. In other words, not based on external conditions. Next is, if you think about it, and this gets easier with practice, well, you don't even need internal conditions. You can just go right to joy. You can just go and literally say, okay, maybe do a little thing in your mind like, may joy arise. That's a traditional evocation of joy. May such and such arise. May piti arise. May sukha arise, you know, bliss or happiness. May it arise. And just kind of maybe inhale a little more vigorously, lift your body a little bit. Just direct access to joy is actually possible. And you can play around with that. And with repetition, neurons that fire together wire together, as we repeatedly have experiences of enjoyment or joy, you know, intense positive emotion, it becomes more and more accessible to us. All right? And then even last, even without self-generating it, what I read from other people and, you know, I can see from in my own experience, there's something about dropping into the ground of being that fills you with joy. Why is that? Why is it that coming into mind as a whole, arising dependent upon the universe as a whole, kind of dropping down into that as deeply and openly as possible without getting all metaphysical about it, just directly going into that, directly relaxing the sense of self, directly coming into the present moment, directly including everything, you know, lived by everything, in that moment, there's like joy. Then it goes, and then it can come again, right? Moments of awakening many times a day. Isn't that kind of radical? I don't know why that is, but many people report that when we drop down into and out into everything, there's like a rush of joy, something about it. Like a peacefulness, a relief, there could be a kind of a lovingness, a heartfeltness in that rush of joy. Boom, we're right there. Okay. And then I want to offer a concluding comment and see what you make of all this. People have different reactions to events, right? And I think about hard times in people's lives of any kind, right? You have had something happen in your life that's painful or difficult, or a health issue, or a child has left home and you miss her dearly, or a relationship is breaking apart, or things happen in the outer world that really bother you. You know, the state of the world, climate change, political events. Maybe some people are very happy about them, and okay. That's their right. Other people are very not happy about them. That's their right too, whatever it might be. And so I find myself really interested in the claiming and welcoming of joy, especially when things suck. Your version of or your definition of sucking really bad, right? And I find that, and there's a particular aspect of that in which for me, maybe they are bad or for myself or other people in ways that feel oppressive, like there's some kind of oppressive process that's occurring. Maybe the game feels rigged in some ways, the playing field is tilted in some ways, or there's some movement of power or authority, domination, maybe in a family system, maybe in a company, maybe in a nation or world, right? That's maybe part of what is, you know, unfortunate or upsetting to a person, feels wrong, all right? Let's say that that's true, you know? Maybe it's true for a kid in school. They're in a situation where they can't win no matter what they do, or they're being bullied, or they're being targeted for through discrimination and so forth. So in the face of that, what's the place of claiming and welcoming joy? And for me, just to offer it, there is a kind of fundamental autonomy and freedom and even triumph that says, no matter what is going on in the external world, I will do what I can to help it. I will do what I can to improve it. But I know my capacities to influence those things are limited. Nonetheless, no matter what, I can still access joy. I can still find joy. You can't take that away from me. You can't frighten me. You can't confuse me. You can't bamboozle me. I still have access to joy. And that is a profound claiming of self-directedness, autonomy, and freedom that I think is useful under any conditions and is particularly useful and important in environments that feel oppressive. Okay. All right. What do you make of all that? What do you think about joy? Enjoyment, claiming enjoyment? Yeah.
So what's the difference? Let's say you get to a higher, I don't know if you could use the word higher, for the other states as you evolve. I assume you can still experience joy in those higher states. So, yeah, what's the difference between so the joy as opposed to the joy of equanimity or concentration, or it's just you're less attached to it, or it's more continuous in those other states?
If I follow you, I'm not sure I get your question.
Okay.
But if I follow you right, what you know people describe is, and you know, I could say for myself, my own journey, you know, on the path, is that what's in the early stages is like momentary, becomes more and more continuous. Yeah. And other feelings are present too, like sometimes the joy, if you will, recedes to the background because you've got to take care of some kind of business. You're driving a truck in traffic and you know, whatever. You're dealing with something. There's been a sudden sharp pain in your lower back that's alarming, and you're what is this? Dealing with that. But over time, nonetheless, this quality of a kind of joyfulness and especially quick access to it becomes more and more available. And I didn't pull it up, but there's a quotation. I'm going to loosely paraphrase it. It's something like, you know, be still and know the sweet joy of the way. There's something about that, you know, and yeah. And more than anything, I want to focus here not so much on those cool possibilities at the top of the mountain of enlightenment, but where are we right now, you know, in the dusty plains or the foothills or the lower mountains or, you know, scratching and clawing our way up some glacier, you know, where are we now? And what's available to you now, tonight, like right now, in terms of accessing, valuing, protecting, and welcoming joy? I think of joy as a kind of civil disobedience, as a kind of, to be able to walk through a mall, and even our cultural disobedience, you know, to walk through a mall with all these, you know, messages saying, you know, you don't really enjoy yourself. You need this, right? You're not really so happy. you know, come over here, right? And to be able to go, hey, I'm stoked already, you know, California speak. Okay, other people, there you are, yeah. Thanks.
I've read stories about that people have an internal set point for happiness.
All right.
Even that's after right. a traumatic event,
yeah.
like being paralyzed or something like that, within 6 months or so, they'll come back to the similar level
yeah.
of happiness. But I think what you're alluding to, joy, might be even beyond their original set point. So maybe you could elaborate on that.
Right. That's a very, you're very, that's a astute and important point you're raising. One of the terms for that is this idea of the hedonic treadmill, that no matter how much you do, you're kind of stuck in the same place. And a couple things about that. The first is that people do tend to return to their baseline if they win the lottery on the one hand or are paralyzed from the waist down on the other hand. But first, the return to baseline is a lot slower after a negative event, which is an example of the negativity bias. So there's an asymmetry in terms of the consequences, first point. And then second, it's really evident that people can lift their set point, and there's actually good research for it. And if you're interested in this, there's a nice paper that summarizes a lot of this stuff. It's quite readable. It's called Beyond the Hedonic Treadmill. And you can just Google it. You can pull it up. And Beyond the Hedonic Treadmill. The point is, and you know it in yourself, that your own practices can increase your mood. Maybe you start out quite anxious and or depressed, and over time, your mood lifts. You've lifted your set point. Similarly, as people do practices in life, they often report more generally that their global sense of well-being is really increasing over time. And I find that really hopeful, you know? The way I think of it myself is that on the minus 10 to plus 10, you know, scale, right? I think it's possible to be just in ecstatic bliss, you know, an 8 all the time, but it's really hard to function, you know, like that. I see, and what I observe is that people who seem to me very far along in present time or in the historical record, they would say, especially when they drop into it, any moment, they just drop into ecstasy. Just they can just go there. And that quality informs their day. So I think it's very possible to minimally lift your resting state, you know, to a plus 5, you know, or 6. That sounds pretty good to me, with, you know, easy access to go even higher as you might want to. And I think there's good evidence for this as well, that this really is possible. Yeah. I think there's like an industry of professional Grinches who kind of rain on the parade, you know, this possibility. And I just think, why? Because, and also there's not good evidence for it either. Yeah, it's good to think about this stuff. Okay, a few more, yeah.
What was the name of that article again?
Beyond the Hedonic Treadmill. It's got one of those weird titles, but it's about the possibility that you're not trapped, you know, and it, honestly, if we all reset to 0, what's the point of any kind of inner practice, right? And so it's important to realize, no, over time, I really can raise my baseline level of well-being, and I can also increase my rate of return to it when I get knocked off. That's another very important thing. Over time, people, you know, they may be able to raise their baseline set point, their thermostat setting of well-being, you know, moderately, only moderately, but their rate of recovery from upset or irritation or anger or stress or physical pain is much faster. You know, your rate of recovery, back to the green zone, back to center, how fast you can come back to center when your partner aggravates you or, you know, you get spun into something that's annoying or worrying. That's a major marker of practice. Okay. Yeah. And positive emotion tends to really support that. Yeah.
Rick, you started this lecture talking about the dopamine.
Yeah.
And I just wanted to get a little neurotransmitter talk.
Everyone else can leave, you know, but no, I'll keep going. Fear not those who enter here, but okay.
So, you know, in Western civilization, we have a lot of rates of major depressive episodes,
yeah.
anxiety, dysthymia, et cetera. Does Buddhism address these anxious syndromes directly, or is it just a benefit intrinsic to the practice of the precepts?
That's a great question. So when we say Buddhism, there's a lot under that tent, right? Where I'm coming from mainly has to do with sort of the our best guess of the early teachings of Northern Indian Buddhism. It's called sometimes called Theravadan branch of Buddhism, from which Tibetan, then Zen, then Pure Land, and I think now Western vehicles, sometimes called jhanas, are developing. So altogether, if you go into the, like if you read the original suttas as best we can gather, what the Buddha taught, written down a few centuries after he passed away, but a pretty good approximation of what those folks were up to, I don't find anything in there about clinical issues. There's some very eccentric and kind of comic yogis that roll into the Buddha's forest from time to time, who bark like dogs or stand on one leg the whole time. The Buddha kind of teases them a little bit about it. So you might say there's a little bit of psychopathology possibly there. But on, you know, maybe, you know, but on the whole, what we think of as modern life, depression, anxiety, trauma, stuff like that, you don't find that. You do find a real recognition of terrible tragedy, pain, and suffering, but it's not psychologized in the way that we would 2,500 years later. So first that said. Second, there are many very senior teachers. You might, if you're interested in this, Mingyur Rinpoche, Sokni Rinpoche's brother, he wrote, I think, The Art of Joy. The Art of Joy, right? I think that's the book, Art of Joy. He grappled himself with clinical depression. And you'll see accounts of other very, you know, kind of developed teachers who will talk about grappling with that sort of thing themselves. Or a beautiful book, Deepa Ma, about Deepa Ma, a woman called Knee Deep in Grace, full of these little stories about her, major, remarkable yogi who came to practice late in life after many tragedies, losing children, terrible pain, illness, mistreatment, various kinds, you know. And she talked about practicing through that. So I think, you know, the takeaway for me is that it's not so much that Buddhism is a treatment. And again, what do we mean by Buddhism? It's not so much that it's a treatment for a particular thing. On the other hand, if you look at it, you know, see for yourself, are there resources there you can draw upon, you know? And I think there's strong evidence, and now I'm speaking as a psychologist, so I'm doing this in a more psychological frame, that one of the major resources for dealing with trauma, anxiety, depression, physical pain, relationship breakup is access to positive emotion. And we develop that access to positive emotion by repeatedly having experiences of positive emotion that are authentic that we internalize. So more and more it's inside us. We don't need to have external conditions be a certain way to access some form of positive emotion. It might be subtle. It might be like a feeling of gratitude or a sense of closeness with someone else, or a recognition that I feel bad, but it's kind of a grim triumph. You know, like a dogged sense of worth and value. I'm hanging in here with this. You know, whatever it is we access, those positive emotions are very reparative. They protect the body against the impact of stress and negative emotion. They literally extend the lifespan, especially the more exuberant, you know, forms of positive emotion. And they are very reparative. They help balance. If nothing else, they can be alongside the negative. I'll kind of finish on this point maybe, and sorry about the people I couldn't get to yet. I'm happy to stick around. You know, as you may know, several years ago, I had a melanoma in my ear, this ear. And melanoma, very aggressive form of cancer. It sat on the surface of my ear. It was discovered. And for about 10 days, I did not know what would happen. So during that period, it was like my mind was a parfait with three layers to it. The top layer was lots of problem solving, rational thought, plans. I had to cancel a teaching trip to Europe. I had to figure out a bunch of stuff, sort out doctors, sort out treatments. If you've ever had a serious health issue or scare, you kind of can know what I'm talking about. The second layer was what the Buddha called first dark territory, where I just felt like a scared animal who just wanted to curl up in a corner of my cave and be petted. You know, that was just fully there. And then alongside that, deeper than all of that, was a feeling of just profound well-being and inner peace that was not touched by any of this stuff. The point is, those feelings, if you will, of well-being or related to that, and I could definitely access it even, like a fierce joy at the life I've had already, no matter when the movie stops, right? You can still feel that alongside everything else. And I think then that makes all the difference in the world. It doesn't necessarily take away from, it's not designed to suppress or cover over the negative, but it becomes a place to stand. You know, the Maori term, a place to stand. We all need a place to stand. The Buddha talked about that more in terms of refuge. And we can take refuge in joy, no matter what. If you really want to stick it to the man, welcome joy. How about we sit for a minute? Take care and enjoy yourselves.
I have a question. Does anybody know where lost objects go here?
Yeah.
Do you?
Oh, is that there? Are you missing something?